My name's Michelle Obu and I'm carrying out this interview on behalf of the Wellcome Trust for the One Another Project. The date today is the 10th of October 2009. The time is now 6:21 a.m. Could you tell me your name, your age and where you're from, please?
I'm Howard Sharman. I'm 56 years old and I'm from Tufnell Park in North London.
Hello.
Good morning.
How are you feeling?
I'm awake. I'm here. That's about all you're going to get.
How did you get here?
My wife gave me a lift. She drove me down in the car, which is very nice of her.
And where is she now?
I've no idea. She may or may not be staying. She may go back to bed and come and get me afterwards. We'll have to see.
Can you remember how you first heard about this project?
Well, I've sort of been living in London. I've been sort of aware of this plinth and the questions about what was going to go on it for some time. And I guess I heard about it when it was launched or when it was announced. I mean, it's been in my mind for a long time.
Did you have any thoughts on what you'd like to see on the plinth?
None at all, to be honest. Most of the things that were suggested before this project seemed to be vacuous, artistically null and void. So, I mean, anything is better than some of the things that were suggested. I think this is an interesting experiment.
What interests you about it? What did you want to take part?
We wanted to take part because we're launching a new NGO, a new charity, and it seemed like a good way to get a little attention, maybe get some sort of publicity, get something that we could use to publicise what we were trying to do.
Who is we?
We is an organisation called Advance Aid, and we are trying to get jobs created in Africa. One of the people who started this off worked in the aid supply industry, so supplying materials for emergency relief, and he saw how appallingly inefficiently it was all organised. So, for example, if there's a flood in Mozambique and lots of people are flooded out their houses, they need tarpaulins, they need shelter, they need tents, they need whatever. And what tends to happen is these things are manufactured in India or in China, and then they're flown across the Indian Ocean and trucked into Mozambique at considerable cost, at huge carbon emissions, a delay. You know, if you're going to make something in China and then you're going to ship it, it's a hugely complicated process. And all that ends up in Africa is a tarpaulin, whereas actually what could end up in Africa is that someone in Africa could be making that tarpaulin and ideally making it somewhere in southern Africa and supplying it to people who need it. So we are going to try to divert the $7 billion a year that's spent on sending emergency aid to Africa into actually creating jobs in Africa to manufacture all those goods.
Why are none of those goods currently being manufactured locally?
Oh, it'll take me more than an hour, but I mean, it's a long and complex story. But basically, all the big aid agencies have large-scale supply agreements with big manufacturers. And African manufacturers are not big. They're not strong businesses. They don't have the sort of balance sheets that can support the stock holdings that are required by the agencies, because the agencies have no money. The whole system is a mess at the moment. There's lots of money there, but it's in the wrong place at the wrong time. So the other day there was an appeal for the floods there's a lot going on at the moment, but either for the tsunami in Samoa or for the earthquake in Indonesia, there was an appeal. Now, the appeal happened 10 days after the event. It'll be another 10 days before the money's there, and then it'll be another 10 days before the money gets spent. So now you've got 30 days, and you've got people who are without for 30 days, because that's the way the system works. The money's there, but it's not released until after something's happened. So we think if we can actually try and release the money before something happens, on the basis that, sadly, it's going to happen. You don't know exactly where, but you know it's going to happen. So you need to move the money to a sensible place where you can use it and deploy it and spend it on local manufacture, hold the stocks, and then release them when they're needed, rather than go scurrying around the world. Everyone goes shopping in a hurry. And when you go shopping in a hurry, you know you don't always, buy the best.
How did you come to be involved in this sector?
Gosh, well, once upon a time I worked in publishing. I was a journalist originally, and then a publisher and a director of a publishing company, and I decided that as I approached 50, I didn't want to be carrying on doing the same thing for the next 15 years. So I looked around for something else to do. And, well, it took a while, but I ended up doing a master's degree in environment and sustainable development at University College just up the road. And that finished about a year ago. And after that, through a friend of a friend, I met my colleague who's involved in Advance Aid, and he was doing it on his own, and we started doing it together.
How long had he been doing it?
He'd been doing it for a couple of years, and he'd been doing a great job in terms of getting around and meeting the aid agencies and publicising what was going on, and we're trying to raise money, basically.
How difficult are you finding it to change the way people work?
It's very hard. Very hard indeed. The aid industry, and it's an industry like the publishing industry or the car manufacturing industry, is very conservative. There's a huge inertia. Everyone does things a certain way. I have to say, the more I go into it, a lot of people have got enormous vested interests in doing things the same way and carrying on doing them the same way. And it's tough to say, hey guys, this is not the best way of doing things. It's also quite hard at the moment to get anyone to open their wallets. There's not a lot of money around. And, you know, if you think it's getting money for new things, getting money for anything new, I've launched businesses, getting startup money is always hard. It's particularly hard at the moment. So it's challenging, and one of the reasons for doing this and doing things like this is, you know, we're generally trying to raise our profile a bit.
How are you going to spend your time?
I don't know. I mean, partly this has come on rather suddenly, so I haven't had an awful lot of time to think about it, which may be a good thing. There are two things that I think I'm going to do. Well, there are three things I think I'm going to do at the moment. One is we've got various sort of little leaflet things, so I was going to fold some up and just fire off some little paper aeroplanes and see where they landed. I'm probably going to witter on a bit, as I've done now, about what it is and what we're doing, why we're doing it. Whether there'll be a human audience, a physical audience, I don't know. But whether there'll be an audience on Sky, I've no idea either. But I'm going to talk. Actually, I'm also going to talk to my daughter, who's in San Diego, where it is now, whatever it is, 10 o'clock. It was 10 at night last night. So she knows it is happening. So if she can get onto the webcam, I'll talk to her. And... What my wife recommended was I use the time for some quiet contemplation.
Have you been out to the countries that you've mentioned?
We were in Kenya a week ago, meeting people, arranging some. I mean, we're going to start there. We're arranging warehousing to begin with, manufacturers. There's a company that's moving its production from China to Kenya. So seeing the factory there, seeing the warehouse, meeting people. I've travelled a lot in the past, but not on Advance Aid business, so that was my first trip.
Have you found it easy to identify, to track down the people that you need to make contact with to affect change?
Quite easy to meet people and get to talk to people in the aid agencies. A lot harder opening government doors. We've been in and out of DFID quite a lot, met a lot of people, very nice, very friendly, very helpful. Everybody, you know, is interested. Everybody we talk to about this idea is interested. So, yeah, you know, why isn't this done already? It's an obvious thing to do. Why not? Why not? Why not? And we get the same response from DFID, but nobody... It's always somebody else's department that funds this sort of thing. And finding the right person... has been very hard. It's a labyrinthine organisation, overlapping responsibilities, and again, we don't quite fall into any natural box. We don't want to deal with what the industry calls the beneficiaries. So we're not going to be running camps. We're not going to be, you know, looking after people. We're going to be a very specialist supply coordination, logistics, and supply organisation. We will make sure that the people who do deal with the beneficiaries, the Oxfams, the Save the Children's, the World Visions, make sure they've got the kit that they need at the time that they need it. And that doesn't fit with the way that the industry is organised at the moment. You know, you're either an aid agency delivering aid or you're a supplier making products. And the idea of someone sitting in the middle who actually makes all this happen efficiently is doesn't fit a DFID box, is my impression. And therefore, you know, we're not in policy, we're not in emergency relief, we're not in development, and so we don't quite fit. But we're working on it. And we're going to go to Brussels next and see if Brussels is any better, but I hold out no short-term hope.
Is there a website for your organisation?
AdvanceAid.org. AdvanceAid, all one word.
And where are you based?
Well, at the moment we're based in, sort of spare rooms and living rooms. We hope before long that if we can get trading in Kenya, and there's also a project we're working on in Singapore with a group of aid agencies. Once we can get trading, we can start to have some proper income, and then we'll have an office somewhere, which will be in North London, somewhere in North London.
What do you do when you're not working? How do you like to spend your time?
Well, I'm an Arsenal season ticket holder. I spend time with my family. Our elder daughter's just moving in with us again at age 27 this afternoon. I've got to go and pick up a street van and move her. She's between houses.
How long is she staying with you for?
I hope it's going to be a fairly short time. We get very ambivalent about this. My wife and I, we both get very, you know, quite upset when they move out and pretty pissed off when they move back in again. So I think a few weeks would be fine.
What did your wife say when you told her you were going to do this?
Why? And then why? And then what do you think you're doing? Which is roughly what I said to myself at 5 o'clock this morning when the alarm went off. Why am I doing this? There's no sense in it.
Was it easy to explain to her why?
Oh, yeah. I'm being flippant. She knows. She understands. She got up and brought me down here. Can't ask for more than that.
Was it short notice?
Yes. Well, it was yesterday evening, 7 o'clock yesterday. So we're a backup. You had a cancellation. In fact, we came down yesterday. I got a call at 10:45 yesterday to say they'd had a cancellation and could we do 12 o'clock. And we scurried around and turned up. We got here by about between 5 and 10 to, and it was too late. And somebody else was on their way. So this is a second go at being a backup.
How did you feel when they called you and told you that you were going to be doing it?
We see, originally it was my colleague who was going to do it, because he's more the showman, you know, than I am. And but he's gone off to Doncaster for the weekend. So he was going to do yesterday, and now he's gone off to Doncaster, and I got the call. And I mean, you know, you finish on Wednesday morning, and I didn't think we were going to get a second chance, so I thought we'd better just do it.
Did you know straight away what you wanted to do up there?
Well, we've known roughly what we want to do, which is we've had this sandwich board thing made. And so the idea was just, originally, we wanted to dress one of us up as a collecting tin. Because the theme, one of the themes, the marketing themes is don't donate, invest. So we're not looking, you know, aid as $2.3 trillion of aid has gone into Africa in the last 30 years, and Africa's poorer now than it was when we started. So aid doesn't do the business. So don't donate, invest. So if you give us the money, it'll go into manufacturing, it'll go into building jobs, etc., etc. So don't donate, invest. So we were going to get a tin made originally. The idea was to get a full-scale tin, you know, more than head high, and have the tin talking. But that was, we have no budget, so that was beyond no budget. But a sandwich board was doable, so we have a sandwich board. And that was always the idea from way back, we were going to do a sandwich board.
Do you find you have to be quite creative in your marketing promotion because you have such a small budget?
Absolutely. I mean, yes. It's all about a bit of creativity, a bit of persistence, a lot of persistence, a lot of sweat, a bit of luck. You know, just keeping on. And yeah, the more creativity you can have, the better. The more you can be off the wall. You know, well, it was Mae West, wasn't it? Better to get looked over than overlooked.
How did you describe yourself on your profile? Did you fill in a profile?
I didn't do the three words. I didn't do the three words, but I should just put don't donate, invest, really, shouldn't I? I can't remember how I described myself. I did it last night in a hurry. I think it was a subset of what I've said to you, which is, you know, about advance aid and why advance aid was doing it. So it was more about advance aid than about me.
And what about you as a person?
What, my profile? Don't like that sort of thing.
Presumably you must be quite a tenacious person because you have to persevere quite hard in the role that you have currently, like you on doors, as you say.
Yes, but I mean, you know, I was trained as a journalist originally, and a journalist, you get on the phone. You know, get on the phone. Make that call. What do you mean you won't talk to your Reem again? Etc. etc. So I mean you learn not to take no for an answer. And I'm happy about that. I don't think I'm a particularly pushy person. I'm a more competitive person than I would think I would necessarily own up to. And you know, that helps too. You know, you've got to want to win.
What kind of journalism was it?
Business journalism. I was writing about marketing and advertising, mainly, which helps in terms of doing marketing and advertising. So I worked for a publishing company who published weekly magazines for niche professions, lawyers, engineers, marketers, designers. And then, of course, you know, it all went into exhibitions, conferences, websites.
Have you always been based in Sussex? Is that where you grew up?
No, that was your other lady.
I do beg your pardon.
6:20 in the morning.
Associated with being from Sussex. I do
wrong
apologize.
Sex,
London,
wrong location.
N19.
Wrong time of the day.
Tufnell Park. So I'll start again. Did you grow up in
Tufnell Park? You're even allowed to edit it, are you now? You know, that
no.
will be there.
No, there it is. It's 20 past. No, it's not. It's nearly 20 to 7 in the morning.
I've lived in Tufnell Park for a long time.
I'm sorry, you're
on. Born in Northampton, grew up in the East Midlands, lived in London for 30 years. North London, all the time. Wouldn't want to live anywhere else, actually. When I first came to London, I hated it, actually. Well, I'd grown up in, no fields, no woods, no nothing. Concrete, you know, all this sort of rubbish. And I used to have to be taken out every few weeks to be shown a field from a car window and taken back again. But now, I love London. I wouldn't want to live anywhere else. It's everything you want is there.
So when did your love affair with Arsenal begin?
Ooh. Well, I've been a season ticket since they built the new stadium, because it was the other one was quite small. I've been going for 10 or 15 years probably, but a season ticket holder for 5.
Who took you to your first match?
One of our neighbours, actually, who I don't see anymore, took me. He was a Leicester City fan, and we went to see Leicester City versus Arsenal when Leicester City were in the First Division, however long ago that was. And then actually I can now go with my neighbour, who's I've been going with for quite a long time, and we have season tickets together, which is very cosy.
Is there anything else you'd like to say before you get up on the plinth?
I'd be really interested to see two things really. One is, I'd really be interested to see how something needs to be made of all of this, three months, 100 days. Some sort of unity, I think. I mean, these are all little disparate acts that are totally disconnected one from the other. And it would be nice to see them somehow cohere into some sort of thing.
Do you have any idea how that might?
I've no idea. I mean, it's really only just occurred to me as a thought that it needs to be integrated somehow into something. One thought. Second is, that hasn't exactly solved the problem of what to do with it. What's going to happen on Thursday, Friday, next month? What's going to be up on that? I mean, I'm sort of asking, is there going to be something there? Mm-hmm. What?
Yannicka Shonibora, it's a ship in a bottle.
Okay. And is that a permanent or a temporary?
It's a temporary. All temporary.
And that's for how long?
I don't know.
Okay. It's not a solution. There needs to be a solution.
Any idea what you would like to see up there? What would you like to see if it was something permanent? Or do you prefer the temporary nature of the commission?
Well, the nice thing about temporaries is there's always a reason to come back, isn't there? And, you know, it gets people back all the time. I mean, but Nelson's permanent, and that's right. I mean, you know, to my mind, I don't think I'm particularly am a traditionalist, but plinths are about statues and about celebrating. I think we ought to try and celebrate a different sort of person. I mean, we celebrate generals and war and politicians and kings and queens. I mean, this is rambling, so I've no idea, is the short answer. But actually, I've no idea. I'm going to stop. I'm going to stop.
You don't want to speculate.
No, because I haven't got anything sensible to say. I want someone to come up with an answer that I look at and say, bloody hell, that was absolutely right.
Thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome.